Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Susan Crane is a serious political activist of an unusual form. Instead of lobbying the powers that be, she takes a hammer to beat on weapons of mass destruction and pours her own blood on those weapons. She says she is called to take these actions as a protest to war and the harm that it causes to our fellow human beings. An occasional visitor to Ukiah, California, where Susan Crane has friends and family, she sometimes visits Radio Curious to give us an update on her life, thoughts, and recent experiences. Susan Crane visited Radio Curious on Labor Day, September 7th, 2009, approximately 10 and a half years since we last visited. She then had just been released from federal prison and picked up her story at that point and brings us up to date on her life. Susan Crane, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you.
So the last time we visited was in March of 1999, and you had just been released from prison.
I was in the federal prison south of San Francisco, FCI Dublin, and I had just gotten out. I was there for a plowshares action where we had gone to the USS Destroyer in Maine and symbolically hammered on the missile hatches to say no to the use of nuclear weapons and the use of war.
I want to get into the reasons why you feel it's important to manifest those symbolisms, hammering on the installations and the transporters of nuclear weapons. But first, tell me about what you've done in the past 10 years.
Well, I've been living at Jonah House. We're a nonviolent resistance community. We do education. We hold retreats. We have a food program where we give away food once a week to people in our neighborhood. We live on a 22-acre cemetery, and we caretake the cemetery. It's a lot of work mowing the grass and keeping the paths. It's an overgrown cemetery, so we are bringing it back to sacred land.
That's in Baltimore, Maryland.
Yes, it's in West Baltimore.
Have you been involved in any other actions or any other acts of civil disobedience in the past 10 years?
Oh, yes. Well, first of all, you know, we call it civil resistance because we're resisting this empire that we're living in and resisting the war. It's a minor point, but we're not disobeying a law in order to change it, which would be civil disobedience, but we're resisting the empire and its war making.
Why? And the why goes to your choice of methods of showing your resistance.
When I look at this country that we're living in, this empire, you know, I see that we've divided the whole world into six different sections. You know, the Northern Command, the Southern Command, the European Command, you know, military areas that this whole world is divided into. The United States has divided.
In the United States military, of which Barack Obama is the commander-in-chief.
Yes. So no other nation does that, divide the world up into commands. And, you know, over the past few years, the power of the embassies in other countries, the money the U.S. embassies has decreased, and the amount of money and power that the commands have has increased. So if you're in some other country and you need some help from the United States, mostly now you don't go to the embassy, the U.S. embassy, which is where you used to go. You go to the military command. So I see that that's happening, and I see that our country, the United States, has between 800 and 1,000 bases in 120 countries, in other countries, and we are an empire. You know, it used to be you were an empire because you had colonies or something, but now we have bases in other countries. And what right do we have to control the rest of the world? I say to myself, you know, what right do we have to spend all this money on weapons and kill people in other nations? I think that's wrong, and I speak out against that.
You said that since we visited 10 and a half years ago, you have been involved in other actions of resistance?
Yes.
Have they landed you in jail?
Yes.
How long have you been incarcerated in the past 10 years?
Well, after I spoke to you, I went back to Baltimore and was involved in another Plowshares action. We had been studying about depleted uranium. This new weapon that the United States had developed, it's called depleted uranium. It's a very heavy metal. It's denser than lead, and it's been used to harden munitions so that they can go through, like a cigar-shaped munition can go through 4 inches of armor, 4 inches of cement. And as it goes through this, the armor of a tank, say, it's pyrophoric and it burns. And what's left are tiny little pieces of dust, ceramic dust, that are radioactive and chemically poison. And they get on people, they get on the people of Iraq, they get on the soil. And so it's like having, well, we all know about lead poisoning in this country and how devastating that is. Depleted uranium is heavier than lead, so chemically it's a worse poison than lead, but it's also radioactive. So it gets in your body and it causes cancer, it causes cell damage. So it creates a lot of birth defects, children born with their organs outside or tremendously disfigured. And so I was learning about that as I went home after talking to you. And at first, I didn't believe that our government would do something so terrible to the people of Iraq and to our own soldiers, because, of course, our own soldiers were contaminated by this depleted uranium, by the munitions that we were using. And then I remembered about Agent Orange and how it took 20 years for the government to finally realize that that was a problem for our own veterans. So I thought, well, maybe we really are using this tremendous radioactive and chemical weapon. And so right down the street from where we live in Baltimore, several miles away, was a National Guard where they had A-10 warthogs. And the A-10 warthogs were responsible for about 95% of the depleted uranium being used in Iraq during the first Gulf War. And so we decided to address those planes, to go to them and pour our own blood on them and to begin to hammer them, to convert them to something that would be useful for human life.
And you were stopped?
After we had poured our blood on the planes, there were four of us. We went to two different planes on the flight line, and we hammered. I was with Father Steve Kelly, who's a Jesuit priest, and we found a ladder underneath the plane we were hammering on, so we opened the ladder up and went up on the wing, and we were able to hammer around the propeller, around the engine. So that's what we did, and we were stopped eventually.
And then what happened?
Well, we went to trial. Well, we were arrested, put in jail, then we went to trial, and we were found guilty, and we were sentenced, and I ended up in prison again.
I'd like to know about your experience in prison, but let's stay with the trial for a minute. Something I've been interested in and in my legal career for the past 40 years. Were you able to provide what's called a defense of necessity? You're familiar with that defense, and maybe you could explain to our listeners what it is and why or why not you were able to provide it.
Well, we weren't able to provide a defense of necessity. And in fact, we thought that we could, because when we've tried to bring up a necessity defense in the past, we were told, well, the danger of nuclear weapons isn't imminent. We could never prove it was imminent. And so we thought, okay, depleted uranium is a poison. It's causing birth defects. It's causing cancer. It's happening right now and it's imminent. Therefore, we'll be able to use this defense. But the judge wouldn't allow that defense. He wouldn't allow us to talk about international law. He wouldn't allow us to talk about freedom of religion. He wouldn't allow any affirmative defense. And we had thought that maybe if we had lawyers help us, usually we go pro se, but this time we had Ramsey Clark, who was the former Attorney General of the United States. He was helping us, and we had a local lawyer also. We still couldn't get any affirmative defense in.
So the issue before the jury was, did you do it or did you not?
Right. Did we hammer on the plane or did we not? Did we pour blood on the skin of the plane or not?
Did you testify in your own defense?
Yes, we did.
What did you say?
Well, I wasn't able to talk about why, about depleted uranium. I wasn't able to talk about why we wanted to go and symbolically begin to disarm those planes. I wasn't able to talk about the effects of depleted uranium on the people of Iraq or on our veterans. So I wasn't really able to say much of anything. We had a person there, Doug Roeke, who was in the U.S. military, and he had come to testify for us in full uniform, and he wasn't allowed to say anything either. He just could listen to the question, the prosecutor objected, and then the judge backed up the prosecutor.
So then what were you able to say, yourself as a witness speaking in your own defense? Did you just step down from the witness stand after your attorney, after Ramsey Clark, asked you why there was an objection, the objection was sustained, and then?
I was also charged with assault. Of course, the furthest thing in my mind would be to assault someone. The whole idea is to stop violence and stop assaulting the people of Iraq with these weapons. So I had to defend myself, as it were, against that charge also. And I was able to say a little bit about why I was there, but really not enough so that the jury could understand that it's against international law to use weapons like depleted uranium. You know, there are laws of war. I'm sure you're familiar with them. And in these laws of war, one army can shoot the soldiers in another army, but they're not allowed to indiscriminately poison a civilian's population that's miles away. And the depleted uranium does that. It can travel for 20 miles on the wind, these little pieces of dust.
Before we go on about your experience in prison and your thoughts on why these actions are chosen, why you choose them, and their effectiveness, I'd like to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Susan Crane, an occasional guest on Radio Curious, about her beliefs in nonviolent resistance and actions to point out what goes on in the munitions production and in the munitions storage area and the damage that's caused in Iraq, for example, the examples that Susan is giving now. And you are listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel, and we're recording this conversation in the studios of Radio Curious on Labor Day, September 7th, 2009. Susan, you were convicted and you were sent to federal prison for the third time. Where did you go?
Well, they sent me to FCI Dublin, which is a couple of hours south of San Francisco. It's a behind-the-fence prison. I was there with all sorts of different women from different countries charged with all sorts of different charges. Many of the women were there for really no reason at all. Some were there on conspiracy charges because perhaps their husband or cousin had done something and they couldn't prove that they didn't know about it. Or maybe they were there because they were poor and they were trying to make some money, were a mule for someone who was dealing with drugs. Or some people were there for passport, having the wrong kind of passport because they trusted someone in their country who was trying to make some money and they got into this country on a false passport. Most of the people that were there, I would be very happy to live with. They were very reasonable and calm people.
How long were you imprisoned on the last charge?
I had a 27-month sentence, and some of that time I did in state prison in Maryland at Jessup Prison. And then I had a year that was tacked on to the 27 months for a supervised release violation from an action from before.
While you were in prison, what was your day-to-day life like? What were you able to do?
At different times I've had different jobs. Everyone has a job in prison. And sometimes I've taught school, like I did here in Ukiah. I taught GED classes. Sometimes I did gardening, also like I do here in Ukiah, or do in Baltimore now. Sometimes I work in the kitchen. I was working in veg prep for a while this last time, chopping up vegetables for the meals during the day. So you do your job, and I usually spend some time on the rec yard getting some exercise, and spend a lot of time talking with other women, helping them, maybe doing some work, helping them write a letter, or just listening. People need help sometimes. They need someone to listen to them.
Looking back on what you were doing and how your life has been, why have you chosen this path as opposed to a path of political lobbying that would perhaps engage in more arguments with people who you speak with, but more likely that you would not be incarcerated?
It seems to me common sense that the weapons that the United States has need to be disarmed. It seems in your best interest and my best interest that we disarm our weapons, at least that we begin to disarm them. And that does not seem to be the political will of the politicians. Now, I think it's the political will of the people if they had the facts. There are a lot of people who lobby. I don't know if they're very effective. Maybe they are. I feel called to say no with my body and to say no with my imagination. And I think of the prophet Isaiah who says, "Beat their swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, nor train for war anymore." And I think that they is us, that we have to begin doing that. That's a very simple thing that me as a very ordinary person can begin to do.
Do you feel that you're effective in changing the minds of the people with the authority?
I don't know how effective any of our actions are, but I do feel that they're the right thing to do. I know that our actions have an effect on individual people.
Do you have other actions in mind?
Well, at Jonah House, we have three retreats that we hold every year. And they're in Washington, D.C. We organize them with the Catholic Worker, the D.C. Catholic Worker, Dorothy Day Catholic Worker. And we plan, they're like action camp retreats, where we do actions. We go to the Pentagon, we go to the White House, we go to the Air and Space Museum, say, or the Department of Energy. And we do various actions there. People get arrested often. And I think those are worthwhile. You know, we need to do more than just talk with our voices, but we need to put our bodies where our voices are and say no to the wars.
Well, Susan Crane, as reported in today's New York Times, today being September 7th, 2009, there's a story of a priest named Carl Cabot who engaged in acts of political resistance in Colorado. What are your thoughts on what he was doing?
Carl went to a nuclear silo, a silo that has underneath it a Minuteman III missile with nuclear warheads that are armed and targeted. And he went to that silo. He cut through the first fence, the farmer's fence. He cut through the second fence. He symbolically hammered on this silo, this 210-ton piece of concrete. He was saying, "I'm going to help Obama out. He wants to get rid of our nuclear weapons," or he says he did. All presidents say that. "These nuclear weapons are against international law. The World Court has said that." Carl was there, and he was arrested, and he went on August 6th, of course, remembering Hiroshima and that the United States used atomic weapons in 1945. I think he did a very good action. So the New York Times wrote an article about it. They interviewed Chrissy, who's one of the people, one of the Carl's support people. And she was saying, that nuclear weapons aren't really an issue that young people in this country are interested in or want to do anything about. And I was thinking, wow, that's a pretty sweeping statement to say, because the United States has, you know, over 5,000 nuclear weapons. We have 10,000 of them stockpiled. And we're saying to every other country who wants to develop them, no, you can't. And if you start to, we might bomb you. So I think it is an issue that people in other countries are very interested in. It's curious to me that in this country there's not an outrage over the amount of money that we spend on these nuclear weapons, and that we have so many of them, and that they are targeted and ready to be launched. We're threatening people all around the world with these weapons. We have Trident submarines that are roaming the ocean with nuclear warheads on them. And we never know exactly where they are. I'm sure people in other countries don't know where they are, but it's a constant threat to people in other countries. And it's a constant threat to us, because why isn't there money for schools? Why isn't there money for roads and infrastructure and job programs and healthcare? I think part of the reason is we're spending it all on war making. We're spending 54 cents out of every tax dollar on war making, on future wars, present wars, and past wars.
Well, Susan Crane, are there things in your childhood or your earlier adult life that come to mind that drew you in this direction?
Well, I really consider myself a pretty ordinary person. I guess I had a somewhat ordinary childhood. I remember that I thought things should be fair, and maybe I still do. I think having a whole bunch of weapons and using them on other people, throwing our radioactive garbage on the people of Iraq, doesn't seem very fair to me. It seems basically wrong, basically unfair.
What do you do in the face of people who would threaten to destroy our country and our way of life, whether those threats are real or they are interpreted by our media to be threats?
I think we need to look at those threats. I think we need to look at people who are angry at the United States. And just like if a person's angry at me, I might want to find out why they're angry, and maybe it's because I'm treating them unjustly. Maybe if we started treating the rest of the world in a more just way, maybe if we withdrew our bases from around the world, maybe if we started helping people instead of giving them more weapons, gave them something that might help the people in the country, maybe people would be friendlier to us. I don't think you make friends by being the biggest bully, and that's the way we're trying to do it. And then when we're feel threatened, well, a big bully is threatening. And people don't know how to respond except by more violence sometimes.
Well, Susan Crane, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, two questions. One is the book question that I know you know. And the other is an important idea or concept that guides your life, that is close to you.
Well, one concept that continues to guide my life and continues to grow in meaning is the idea of nonviolence, the idea of responding in a forgiving and friendly and loving way to people, no matter what they throw at me. I think being nonviolent is important to all of us. It's important to me. It's important to people in my community. I think that's the basis of all religions, having a heart of compassion, having love, having forgiveness.
And can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
One book that really stays in my heart is called Enemy Combatant, and it's by Mozam Beg. One reason why it really stays in my heart is that I recognize myself in a lot of his thinking and what he did in his life. He grew up in England. He was Muslim. His father wanted him educated well and sent him to a local Jewish school because it was the best around. As he grew up, he realized that in Bosnia and in Afghanistan and other countries, the Muslim people were being attacked, were being fought against. And so he thought, well, I should do something to help them. So he started giving them money. And then he realized, well, it's not enough to give people who are in great need just money. I should give them food. So he started collecting food. And then he thought, well, it's not enough to just do that. I should deliver the food. And he went on this convoy of mercy to Bosnia to give people food. And he was giving people like a can of meat, a tin can of meat or something. And he thought, well, this person is going to go back and eat this and then have nothing, and I'm going to go to my home in England and, you know, live a good life. So he thought, well, this isn't enough. It isn't enough to just be charitable. And so he thought that he should do something to bring about justice. He ended up getting money together, opening a bookstore to educate, and going to Afghanistan to help build schools for girls and drinking water wells. And not only did he go, but he brought his wife and his children. So they were living there in Afghanistan, and then 9/11 happened, the U.S. started invading, dropping bombs, and all internationals really had to leave. So he left, and he and his wife got a house on the edge of the Afghani border in Pakistan. And they were going to make it like a home or a place for refugees from Afghanistan to stay. And he was there working on his computer one night, and Pakistani and American people came in and arrested him. And he ended up in Guantanamo. He was in Guantanamo. He suffered through the torture, the isolation, the feeling he would, being told he would never see his family again. And finally, he was released. He went back to England. He wrote a book about his experience. And he writes this book not in a spirit of revenge, but in the spirit of, we have to work together to build a better world where there's not intolerance and where there's understanding. And that was very moving to me.
Well, Susan Crane, thank you for coming to Ukiah and for visiting us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry, for having me.
Susan Crane is a political activist who, instead of lobbying, takes a hammer to beat on weapons of mass destruction and pours her own blood on those weapons. She visits Ukiah, California from time to time and drops in on Radio Curious. The book that Susan Crane recommends is Enemy Combatant: My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Begram, and Kandahar by Mozam Beg. This interview was recorded on September 7th, 2009. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format. To get a copy, visit our website for further details. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.